Thanks so much, Gigi, for that introduction. I just want to tell everyone here, if you're on Twitter, we are going to use a hashtag for this session, and we're going to say make a diff, like make a difference, but just D-I-F-F. So that'll be the hashtag if you want to quote the fabulous speakers we've got here today. So I'm just going to go down the line and give our speakers an opportunity to introduce themselves and orient them here and let you know a little bit about how they got from point A to point B in their career. So Sylvia, let's go ahead and start with you. You are the CEO of Communicard, so tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, so I'm an engineer, and I'm a systems engineer. And so I'm really excited to be here, and I thank you for being here, because sometimes when you're a do-gooder, and I think a lot of you in this room are trying to do good, right, and make a change in the world, you don't normally think of engineers that way, right? And systems engineers, come on, we're about efficiency and process. Come on, what is that? Well, actually, I was in technology, and I got invited to mentor. And I began to see the huge need that we have in education. But I realized my skills are much better at the many instead of one-on-one. And as I did more research, I found that in Texas and basically west of the Mississippi, we have this amazing growth in our child population. Kind of a little factoid, I am an engineer, so I have to give you some numbers. I know. So here's the thing. From 2000 to 2010, of all the increase of children in the U.S. under five, one in three were in Texas. Yowza. Yeah, yowza. And if you add Florida, that's like half of all the increase of children. So California still has more children under five, but we're catching up very quickly. So I saw that we had this huge baby growth, unlike others. So when you have a huge growth like that, you have to scale. And the word scale means growing efficiently. That's like, man, you know, that's wonderful talk to engineers. But what I saw that in the social helping world and in the education, they excelled at the one-on-one, but not the one-on-many. And I realized you didn't need another nonprofit. So what we did was we created an organization that didn't provide direct services, but we actually looked at all these nonprofits. I called the 1,000 points of scattered light. There's all these people who were doing things but wasn't unified around our great population growth that we're having in Texas and other states. So how I use my professional systems background is we created a mobilization campaign where we identify and target and train nonprofits who are responsible for interacting with our growing, rising generation of youth. We train them, and then we identify their needs. And their needs are like, so how do we talk to the fast-growing Spanish-speaking parent population, which makes up half of our kids in Texas? And they say they don't care and they don't come. Well, we work with them to create messages and training, and then we bring them together. And in the 6 years that we've been doing this mobilization campaign, when people tell me no one would show up because I didn't have alcohol, I didn't have music, and I didn't have free food, our first year, 3,500 people showed up, and now we're up to 13,000 here in Austin, but we've now done this in other markets, Los Angeles, and we have reached over 200,000 people and given away 215,000 books. And so what we do is we organize systems so we have thousands of one-on-one experiences. So that's kind of what I do and how I used my engineering skills for good.
That's terrific. Thank you, Sylvia. Awesome. Charlie, our t-shirt and jeans individual today. Patty first.
Please.
Patty first. Ladies first. On to Patsy it is. Patsy, you are the founder of I Live Here, I Give Here. So tell us a little bit about that organization, how you got involved.
I will. Well, so you have a chemist following an engineer. I was trained and worked as a chemist when I started my career, and then stepped back to raise kids for a while and went back to the workforce working for our local United Way doing development, because I had, while I was at home raising kids, developed a lot of fundraising skills as a volunteer. So while I was at United Way, there was a study that came out ranking the 50 largest cities in the U.S. with regard to charitable, with regard to percentage of income dedicated to all charitable giving. And Austin We love Austin. It's the best at most things. It is not the best at charitable giving. And a group said, let's just see if we can do that. So the chemist in me said, well, let's look at the data. Let's see what people think. And we started out by doing some research, some local research about people's attitudes about the community, their attitudes about charitable giving. And what we found is that only 1 in 3 Central Texans feel like they understand what the problems are in this community. And at the same time, 8 out of 10 said if we understood better, we would be more generous. So with that research under our belt, we began to develop hypotheses, which are things that chemists develop. How can we move that needle? What will we do to make it to increase charitable giving across Central Texas? We will educate and inspire. So we develop programs to do just that. The programs were in the realm of what are the problems, back to that original research. Each month we shine a spotlight on a community issue and talk about the folks working to provide solutions to that issue. And our goal is to be the matchmaker, to make the connection. The other program we do are mentoring dinners called See Jane Give and Give Back Jack. And what we know is what we do in those dinners is we seat 6 to 8 individuals at a table with a professional who is highly accomplished, highly respected, and highly philanthropic. And they talk about their journey and the role philanthropy has played in their life's journey. And again, back to the chemist we tested. So we went to the RGK Center, and they did some independent testing of our programs in the first couple of years. And what we know is that the individuals who are exposed to I Live Here, I Give Here programming are giving more in the community. And I could go into details, but you probably don't want details at this point. We've also merged with a small program called Austin Involved, and that takes young professionals. They it's sort of a survey of philanthropy across the community. They give $25 a month, decide where they want each month, take a look at our community spotlight issue, and select a nonprofit to give their dollars and their time to. So they're seeing overall what's the problem. Here's how nonprofit X is meeting the problem hands-on. So to the scalability issue you talked about, on March 4th and 5th, we are working to scale all of this groundwork that we've laid in the 5 years that we've been in existence with an annual day of online giving. It's called Amplify Austin. We want to mobilize the community-wide to make a gift online to the charity they care most about. Our goal is to raise $1 million in 24 hours, and I think we will absolutely do that.
Thank you, Patsy. That's wonderful. And I just want to add, too, that I Live Here, I Give Here is what connected me with the Austin Humane Society, where I'm now a cat socializer. So
I love it.
Has been a win-win for both. Well, definitely me, hopefully the cats also. Charlie, you are the president of the Pay It Forward Foundation. You have a diverse background. So tell us about how you got involved.
Two things. I don't know what the hell I'm doing up here. I'm an engineer and a chemist. Secondly, my bag has been lost, or I would be a little bit more dressed up. So, okay. Quickly, I born and raised in Salt Lake City. I grew up a typical kid. Thought I needed physical possessions to make me happy. House, car, money. Fell into the same trap that most Americans do. Worked my butt off since the age of 15 till the age of 30. Saw the movie Pay It Forward. The age of 20, about 12 years ago, really impacted my life. I worked my way up to the business of owning it, had everything I ever wanted, plus some, more money than 99% of the face of the planet, was absolutely miserable. And about 18 months ago to the day, I walked away. So I don't have a profession anymore. 18 months ago, I just walked away and committed to the Pay It Forward movement. It's a global movement in 150 countries that has been around for thousands of years. It's just never been given direction. And now that we've given it direction, we are sitting in front of you and doing some very cool things.
Great, great. Well, one of the first questions I wanted to ask all of you guys is, it seems like all of you, and I'm willing to bet many individuals in this room, had a come to Jesus moment where you assess your career path and said, you know what, I'm not sure this is exactly what I want to be doing. I actually want to apply my skills and my heart in a different direction. So maybe I'll start with you first, Sylvia, our former literal rocket scientist. If there was a particular day, you gave us a really great background of your macro journey, but if there's a particular day where you said, you know what, I think I can actually use my skills to give back.
It was a toothbrush. So, you know, I was mentoring this girl, and I noticed she had really bad dental hygiene. And so even though you weren't, as a mentor, supposed to bring snacks, I brought some light snacks, and then I brought a toothbrush and toothpaste. So that after we'd eat the snack, I said, well, now we go and we brush our teeth. And I realized she didn't have a toothbrush at home. She didn't know how to do this. And so I said, so let's keep it so next week we'll have that. Well, the next week there was no toothbrush or toothpaste. So then I said, okay. So then every time I would mentor her, I would bring a small snack and then the toothbrush and toothpaste. So I went through six different toothbrushes and toothpaste, and then suddenly she had it at school. And I said, oh, well, you know, you're not losing anymore. She goes, no, I just had to get a toothbrush for everyone in my family. And I realized that there was so much, you know, me in my cubicle and, you know, living life in airports and all that kind of stuff, that I realized there were some real basic untapped needs that existed out there. And then I began investigating them. And the hard thing is that once you know something, you can't unknow it. And so, you know, dental hygiene is just one of those things. Vision is another one. And so you realize, I obviously couldn't give toothbrushes to every kid, but my systems skills can arrange to get a lot of toothbrushes to, you know, so our events, our mobilization events, you bet we're giving away toothbrushes and toothpaste. But now one of the spin-offs that I've done is I also realized when I was there, she was supposed to wear glasses, but she didn't wear glasses because they were broken. And it cost, you know, $35 to fix glasses. And then that helped me understand that 10% of our low-income kids need glasses but can't get them for a variety of reasons. And so, you know, 18 months later, now we're going to have a vision van in Austin where we will take the van to the school so the kids can get the glasses made on the spot. But when I tell people that, we live, you know, especially those of us who are in corporate America, we live a life and we don't realize that there are third world needs in our neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. You know, 70% of Austin ISD is low socioeconomics. That means they get free and reduced school lunches. That's mind-blowing in such an affluent city. So I realized that the problem seems so overwhelming, and one of my skills is, you know, I can manage events easily for 50,000 people and maybe break a sweat. But it's like, that does not daunt me. Mm-hmm. It's scalable and organizing. So that kind of, I realized I could use the logistical issue of organizing for thousands of kids stops a lot of people, but I realized I could use my powers for good on that.
You know what strikes me as you were talking, Sylvia, is just the power of story. Just that one story of a child who didn't have a toothbrush and her teeth were falling out was the thing that moved you to realize, you know what, I bet this story is not uncommon. I bet a lot of children have this story. So that leads me to you, Patsy, in realizing that what Austinites truly needed to hear was stories told about the needs in the community. And for people that want to get involved in nonprofits and philanthropic work, can you speak to the need a little bit about defining a narrative to illustrate that need to a community and how you bring that those stories to people's attention?
Yeah, it is critical. You're exactly right. You know, we tend as human beings to primarily have a heart reaction and mm-hmm. to be motivated to take action based on a heart reaction. You know, I tend to, you know, like to talk about, and lots of us tend to, in the nonprofit world, tend to like to talk about numbers, but, you know, it's a story that talks to your heart first that will motivate someone to action. So while our target market at I Live Here, I Give Here is the general public, age 28 to 40, we work a lot with the nonprofits that we're presenting to that general public, and helping them sort of boil all those numbers down to one story or two stories, and then help people understand that there are lots of those stories across the community. Another kind of story that we focus on, which is different than most, is we also work a lot with people who support the nonprofits in this community to tell their story, to tell how it makes them feel to make a personal gift, to solve a problem in the community. Because most of us act, you know, out of wanting to do something good, wanting to feel good. And so if we can, you know, have one individual talk about the return they get when they make a gift, we believe that that will motivate others to act in that way, to seek that same satisfaction.
That's terrific. That's terrific. Charlie, let's hand it over to you. What are some appropriate channels for that kind of storytelling? Have you found in your work that it's a social media call to action? Is it, I know on KUT tells a lot of those stories from I Live Here, I Give Here, which is our local NPR affiliate. What has been the channel of storytelling that's gotten people to respond? So if someone here wants to go out and get involved and rally other people to their side, how do you disseminate those stories out there and start motivating people?
Ooh, that's a tough question, because there's this false sense of power in social media. I'm kind of in the line with Malcolm Gladwell, where he talks about Martin Luther King and the sit down and everything that was going on with civil rights, and that physically getting someone to do something, actually take that action, not just reshare a Facebook post or retweet something, is next to impossible in today's world. Being able to sleep easier at night because you simply passed on a message on Facebook, I don't want that to end, but I want people to create actual action, to physically put their body in the way of doing something good, and we've lost that. A billion people on Facebook, 300 million or something on Twitter, and it's just a hollow sense of connection. That really doesn't answer your question, but the best way to get a story out is social media. To spread a message, yes, it is social media, to spread it through Facebook and through Twitter and through LinkedIn and through whatever, but to physically get them to do something, to write a check, to physically come to a homeless shelter, to physically be part of these organizations here in Austin, that is a question I would like answered myself.
Yeah.
I don't really know. There's still a lot of talk, mm-hmm. and we need action, because I would assume everyone in this room wants the world to be better.
Yeah. Well, that actually leads us to a really important point, Charlie, because I was talking with Gretchen Rubin downstairs about this response that we're seeing right now in the 2010s, so this, you know, digital high-tech culture, people craving that sense of connection, helping each other out. It's probably why a lot of you are here, wanting to get away from behind your computers and go out in the community and see the fruits of your actions, help people in the real world. So do you think that's positive for philanthropy? Do you think that's positive for charity, that we're getting a little bit kind of a tech weary? We're actually wanting to go out into the world. How can we capitalize on that? People wanting to leave their computers and go do something good when we're so inextricably matrix-like bound up in social media, the internet, and all of that.
I think it's simply the pendulum. It goes up and then comes back down. And right now, I think it's hitting that peak of social media. I mean, a billion people on one website is just immense. I think it's coming back the other way. I think the fact that you guys are here today in person, and it's not a telecast or something via the computer, is a good sign. But I think we're moving back towards people actually wanting to physically doing something. The one problem is, in today's world, we have far too many choices. So we have tens of millions of people in this country and worldwide that want to do something to make the world a better place. They simply just don't know where to start. So we need to simplify how we can at least get started to hopefully get people in a better mindset so when these nonprofits and charities come calling for time and money, the chances of you saying yes shoot through the roof.
Terrific. Well, let's shift the conversation a little bit to hard-scale how-tos. If there are people here in this room who are in the corporate world, but they want to start using their time, their skills, maybe even their funds to beyond the for-profit sector, talk a little bit about how you guys made that move. Like, Charlie, you left your job. You quit and started something else. Patsy, you were raising your children and then came back and started something. So how do people do that? Do they have a Kickstarter and they start fundraising to launch this thing? Do they start volunteering with an organization on the side? What worked for you in making that transition? This can be for anybody.
Well, I think my moment involved skinning rats, Sylvia. I had gone back to school to get my master's in biochemical nutrition. And there I was. You know, I'm a daughter of the late 60s, early 70s. The message we got was, you can do anything. And the harder it is, the better you are. Mm-hmm. And so that's probably why you became an engineer, or, you know, why I became a chemist, because it was hard, I could conquer it. And so that was kind of the path I was on. So let's go get our master's degree. And I, you know, I'm working in that lab, and I'm thinking, what the heck am I doing here? Why am I doing this? Who cares if, you know, this particular study I'm working on about fat in, you know, the kinds of fats in mouse skins, you know, what, who cares, really? I mean, ultimately, you know, people care, but it's so far removed that I just went, you know, I'm just not going to do this anymore. And I've, you know, developed these skills as a volunteer, and I'm going to go see where I can, you know, marry the analytical skills I had developed through, you know, formal education and the volunteer skills I had developed over time, and went to work, like I said, at United Way, raising money. So I think, you know, there is a moment in our lives that where you just say, what am I doing and what is this for? And, you know, if I could change one thing in the world, what would it be? What would my one thing be? And maybe I can't do it today, but, you know, maybe I can take one step in that direction, and then, you know, marshal your limited resources in that direction.
You know, and I think she brings up a great point. You know, where do you start so it doesn't have to be so overwhelming? And when I was still working in corporate America, one of the things that I started doing is, you know, I said, you know, we don't need to do Secret Santas in our department anymore. You know, we all have stuff, right? So why don't we go, and I went to the United Way and I said, you know, how can we help? And they said, well, you can adopt a family. And so we got a list of things that a family needed. And so instead of doing Secret Santa, we did that. And then another year we bought books for a school library. And so we got, you know, $2,000 and bought a bunch of great books for a library. And then another year I went to, I asked what my team, what type of nonprofit they wanted, and they thought it was really great. So I went to go meet them and I said to the ED, give me a list of what you need. And we were shocked, you know, like they said they had a budget for a stapler. Like, huh? You know, and it was just amazing for people in the for-profit world to see how threadbare a lot of nonprofits actually run. And so for those of you who are thinking about making the switch and you think, well, I want to go into nonprofit world because, you know, I want to do good. It's true. But you think, well, I won't have to worry about money, as Patsy can tell you. And, you know, money becomes a really big part. It's the oxygen, you know, cash flow is the oxygen of a nonprofit. And then you end up in some nonprofits actually budgeting for staplers, because that's an expense. So, you know, I began those little steps by starting to actually go and experience and meet those groups, and it was really eye-opening. Again, another factoid, but from 2000 to 2010, the number of poor children in Texas in schools would be the seventh fastest growing state in the country.
Wow.
I mean, that's just immense. I mean, more than the entire state of Colorado grew is just the number of poor kids. So I bring that up because one thing, I've gone to some the poorest of the poor schools. Those kids are starving, folks. I mean, not hungry. I mean, they're literally starving. And you know, how can you learn when you can't eat and there aren't, like, you know, stores nearby or healthy food choices? It's just really amazing. So you begin to see, you know, in your world how different other people are living, and that population is growing very fast in the state, and so their needs. So to help understand that, if that's kind of where you're focused on, I know a lot of other people are interested in arts and music, and those are all amazing things, but I'm really focused on education and health and fitness, and to see that, you know, there's kids that don't have balls, there's kids that don't know how to kick, catch, and throw. So you realize it's not as overwhelming, but just start with, you know, a basic toehold. Maybe your secret Santa is a family in need, you know, and then grow from there.
Right. Terrific. I loved what you said earlier, Patsy, about marshaling your one thing. And it strikes me as, you know, how difficult that is when you're in your career, stuck in your cubicle, and you feel a stir to get out in the world and do something larger, but you don't know exactly what that looks like or what that is or what your contribution could be. So, Charlie, since you've made this transition somewhat recently, can you speak a little bit to everyone in this room about how do you hone in on your one big thing? When you're starting to feel the stirrings of, you know, philanthropic, giving, social good in your heart, but you really don't know what your contribution could be, how do you start assessing yourself and what you could reasonably give back?
Another tough question for me to answer, because I was, I'm just in a very good position where I could leave. Most people aren't. I think everyone in this room and many more people in this world have that feeling, all three of us have, of where we want to do something, or we have a need to, you know, what are we doing in our day-to-day lives? What are we doing for our kids? We want the world to be better. We don't know what to do. I think we all have that feeling. We just, most of us suppress it. I don't remember who quoted it, but actions show priorities. And I just murdered that quote, but you get what I'm trying to say. Start small. Do something. Get out there. There's something in this room that everyone has, whether it's homelessness, whether it's poverty, whether it's breast cancer, whether it's something. You have something you care about, something you've been impacted by. Do something. I'm just a very simple person. I'm the polar opposite of these two when it comes to details. Mm-hmm. Just do something. You know what you want to do. At least get to Googling or checking out what's close to you or seeing what organizations next to you or if they need money or if they need toothbrushes or glasses or something simple you have in your closet that you completely take for granted. Start somewhere and hopefully build some momentum to getting into something larger and more impactful.
You know, to embroider on that a little bit, Charlie, I found that for me, kind of mining my childhood memories about what stood out to me and what I remembered was a good gauge about the things I cared about and the things that I could see myself over a long period of time devoting time and resources to. And aside from being a cat socializer at Austin Humane Society, which has been fabulous, thanks to you, one of the things I've gotten involved in is working with the elderly and also working with the homeless elderly. That came about because my mom, when I was a little kid, I guess at about age 11, started using our Thanksgivings to volunteer at the San Antonio Convention Center, where HEB had a dinner every year for San Antonio's homeless. And so she took us there. We started, we just volunteered as servers. Sometimes we painted little kids' faces. But it was a convention center just as large as this one, filled with homeless. This room, you would all be homeless. The meeting rooms next door, all homeless. All lining up to get food for Thanksgiving. And that was one of those things that impacted me so deeply that I realized, you know what, this is something, if that memory, I'm sure I've had other, you know, moments in my childhood life where I was involved in some kind of organization, some kind of charity, some kind of school outreach effort. But the fact that that memory stuck with me so much, it made me realize, okay, maybe that's something that over a long period of time I could enjoy doing since I still remember it. So. Okay, well, this is something we were kind of talking about on the way up, addressing that transition from the for-profit world to the nonprofit world, and maybe some people have the impression that that's not difficult when it is actually extremely difficult. So can we speak a little bit to the practical transition? Say someone here in this room works for a company, they're doing great, much like Charlie, but they don't feel good at night. How do they make that transition to a 501c3? How do they start their own nonprofit? How do they get involved? What are the difficulties and the surprises you encountered along the way that people should be aware if they're trying to make that transition?
You want me to start?
Sure.
Back again to what Sylvia said, you probably will not have a lot of assistance in the nonprofit world, and you might be counting staplers. A lot of people sort of worry that there's a lot of waste going on in the nonprofit world. You hear that often is, you know, what's your administrative overhead? Or, you know, I would challenge you that nonprofits, most of them, the large majority, obviously you're going to have a bad apple here and there, run on fumes most of the time. And so that would be one huge transition piece. Another thing is, you know, if you find your passion and you think you have a solution to a problem in the community, I would encourage you highly to look for an organization that is already doing similar work rather than starting a nonprofit. If you can find funding for that work, and then the work is in alignment with the mission of the nonprofit, I would think they'll welcome you with open arms to be a program within a nonprofit. And then if you can't find that and you decide you want to start something on your own, I think you cannot underestimate the value of patience and persistence. A good idea may be a good idea, but for people to embrace it takes a lot of hard work and takes time.
You know, I really wanted to echo what she said. It really does take time. And so one of the things, if you're thinking about making that change, it really helps if you have a partner or spouse with health benefits. Okay, that is really important because a lot of nonprofits can't afford that. So, you know, those are like real basic issues to think about. So having that. The other thing is, you know, as she mentioned, a lot of time. You know, one of the things that we discovered is, you know, 10% of our kids need glasses. So you'd think that's a no-brainer, right? I mean, you can't see, you can't learn, you can't take those standardized tests. You know, it's taking us over 18 months. You know, I thought we'd be done. I thought we'd have Austin seeing 2020 by 2012. And we're just getting the project funded and started. So, you know, I've put 18 months of just pure sweat equity, and I won't make any money. And also, instead of starting something new, I saw that there was a model that was working in Dallas, and we are bringing that here, so not having to recreate something. There's a saying in Austin, whenever two people are gathered, they form a nonprofit. So Patsy's point is really good because there are so many nonprofits. So I'd really encourage you to do some research and to see if anybody's already doing something similar so that you don't have to recreate the wheel, but you can actually join them and join forces to follow that, you know, whatever it is that's your passion. And then the other thing, too, is I would, before you, like, chuck it all and just say I'm going to go into the nonprofit world, you know, try it a bit, you know, do volunteer for those groups and be part of that. Mm-hmm. When you actually see what the daily life is like in nonprofit world, it's like, oh, we don't have funds to buy the toner paper for the printer. And so where can we go to one of our partners to print stuff? I mean, it's been pretty amazing to see how some nonprofits are really, as you mentioned, threadbare.
What they said.
but you know what? But there are and a lot of obstacles. But you know the thing and having that drive. But one of the things for me that has always stayed true. So yeah, there's a lot of obstacles, but that true north of why you're doing it. Right. So I really believe that what I'm working on is making America better. I feel very patriotic in my work. And part of that is, you know, my mom, she didn't speak English, but she took me to her church where she found a bilingual missionary. And she had that bilingual missionary teach me how to read in English. And the first thing that she had me, well, the first words in English were, Jesus loves little children, you know. But the second one was the Pledge of Allegiance. And it really struck with me that, you know, being bilingual was an and, not an or. And I see this huge, you know, half of our kids in Central Texas, in Texas and in California have that opportunity, and they can really strengthen America. It's if we treat them as an and, not an or. And I know that will make America even stronger. And so my American patriotic sense, you know, all my events, I always have the American flag, because that is really what drives me. I want to make America even stronger and better. So we will, you know, deal with all the issues that we have to deal with to make that, because of that strong core purpose that I have.
I love that those true North remarks, Sylvia, and that made me think of a question while you all were talking. Why do you think social good entrepreneurs are needed now at this historical juncture? In late 2012, we're running up to a presidential election. Who knows what will happen? Why are social good entrepreneurs needed at this moment in history?
Well, one of them is, you know, we've had an amazing social safety net for the baby boomers, and we're really deconstructing that. And also we're growing in a way that's different. And the, you know, how do you create the future that you want? And so government isn't going to fund that. So you need organizations to step in to help create that future and that community that you want. And that's very much an entrepreneur's opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Einstein says the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. Every year we continue to cut checks for hundreds of billions of dollars for the world's largest problems, and statistically most of them get worse. This is a very, very unique time. I'm really trying to go back in history, even though I'm so young. I'm trying to think of other times, read up a lot on history, read up on a lot of other movements, ask a lot of people that are wiser and older than I, or not so young, that's should say it that way. it just seems different. Does it not seem different? I know we've been through the Depression. I know we've been through wars. I know we've been through a lot in the past and everything in this country and this world. But with technology and the access that a five-year-old has to know that the world is as bad as it is or as good as it is, it just seems different. And I can't think of a better time for people to be just a tiny bit more socially conscious. Now, we're not asking for much. We're not asking for anything drastic. I'm not asking anyone to do anything I did, leave their job. But just imagine if everyone in this room woke up tomorrow and was just a tiny bit nicer than they were the day before. And they started thinking about little tiny things they could do on a day-to-day basis that could help the company, make it more green, be more socially responsible, kick back some money back to some foundations. Just imagine if we just did a tiny bit more and millions of people did that. I think it's the time. I think it's just a very unique time and we need it.
Yeah, it seems like there's... both of you speak to this trend I'm kind of seeing right now, too, is the heart of philanthropy with the tricks of free market and entrepreneurialism. Maybe the poster child company for this is Tom's Shoes, for example. But Kiva, one of my favorite organizations, where you can perform a micro loan to somebody in need in a third world country that's trying to get their business off the ground, and then they pay you back. And instead of just giving money to an organization, you know, just a big faceless organization, you're giving money to Mr. Riojas in Colombia, who is trying to buy a sewing machine so he can start his clothing business. Or you're giving a $5 loan to a woman in Africa who wants to buy a cow and start making cheese, something like that. And then, so back to that storytelling, I think that we're in a really interesting time in the wake of, freelancer culture, contractor culture, entrepreneurialism. That's been made possible through the internet. So people are using those opportunities to fund social good projects. On the heels of that topic, I want, if each of you can give me your main three ingredients for starting a social good company, what are the main things you need? Do you need a website? Do you need a business plan? Do you need a funder? What are your top three ingredients for getting your social good company off the ground?
Well, I think the first thing you have to do is identify a need. So, is there a problem? Decide if it's a big problem or a little problem. Then I think you need to do your homework and figure out how to meet that need. So you got to identify a need, have a plan to meet the need, and then be able to tell your story. With those three things, I think then you can go get, you can, you know, build out alliances, you can get funding, but those are the three things I think you need at the basic.
I would agree with her. And you know, when you're working in social entrepreneurship, you're in the business of hope. You really are. No matter if it's about art, homelessness, education, you're really there to give people hope for a better life, hope for a better life for their families. You're really in that business of hope. So, you know, how do you define that in terms of the need and the business plan? And but, you know, think about how do you provide hope around whatever that need is, whether it's, like I said, homelessness, art, music, education. And when you think about hope, that's a very inspirational aspect. And then that's kind of where your story comes in. You know, I think about when we solve our need, you know, we bring hundreds of organizations to parents who don't know how to navigate our U.S. system. And suddenly we make it so easy and welcoming that they want to do that, and you begin to see them having hope. Hope for themselves, for their family, and for their children. So figuring out where that need, and then how do you address that with hope?
The only thing I would add is persistence. That would probably be my first three things. The people we've met in the past couple of years, from the top to the bottom, to the poor to the wealthy, to amazing people, to people who are starting to become amazing. The one thing with successful people that I have found out of every question I've asked them, they chose not to give up when everyone else did. Mm-hmm. A lot of people find something tough in their lives and say, this is God's way, or this is someone's way of saying it's not the time, or it's not the right place, or it's just whatever. It's an excuse to bail out on something. Those who make this world better are the ones who choose not to give up. So persistence for sure.
Good answers. I want to ask kind of an out of left field question for all of you. It seems that with the rise of Pinterest and the web video getting more and more sophisticated, that visuals are really powerful in telling a story and calling people to action. So what's great about social media is that you can use these tools for free to get faces in front of other people. And I read a statistic about Facebook ads that one that features someone's face get an 80% more click rate than someone that ads that feature a logo. So, and I've noticed in my own career that as a writer, the more I can involve visuals in my storytelling, the more of an impact it seems to have. So can you talk about involving visuals in your efforts, and whether it be a billboard, whether it be on your website, whether it be a little homegrown video that you made, vlogging, whatever you're doing. Talk to me about visuals and how it's furthered your efforts.
All right. So, you know, the audiences that I address are 90% low income, right? And so we did a bunch of research, and turns out there's this wonderful person, Dr. Ruby Payne, and she's done a lot of work about how to get people out of poverty. And there's four bridges out of poverty, and one of them is visualization. Because sometimes people in poverty don't know and aren't surrounded by people who can help them get out, and they don't even know what's available to them. And so in all of our events, we have photographers who take pictures of kids, and kids in cap and gown, kids as doctors, kids as scientists, kids as engineers, kids as astronauts. And those pictures are so impactful in their high-quality color pictures. And that was really brought home to me one year when we had done an event, and the mom, when you're finished with a big event like that, you just want to go home, right? And this mom came up, and she didn't speak any English. She spoke some Spanish, and she did not have much literacy. But she said, I came on a bus, and I wanted, and my daughter got a picture of herself as a teacher. And before the picture printed, our bus was leaving, so I had to go home. And I went and I knocked on every door in the apartment till finally somebody had a car to take me back all the way to Travis County Expo, which is where we had the event that year. And she said, I want that picture because I want to show my daughter I believe in her dream. And, you know, I realized, wow, the power of that visualization. So in every one of our events, we have a visualization zone. Part of it's because I used to live in California, so, you know, you visualize. But, you know, it's also really inspiring when you see a parent, they themselves, and then put on the cap and gown, and many of them haven't had that experience. So the power of visual is just so strong.
It's terrific. It's terrific.
You know, one of the things that we've done to that end is we do videos each month along with our community needs spotlights. And we started out doing videos of executive directors telling their story. And we have evolved to now having donors talk about the work that the agencies they support do in an effort for you, the audience, to see yourself as donor number X. They're telling the same story about the work of the organization, but they're also, again, talking about the return they get in supporting that organization. And, you know, on our face, I'm old, so I'm not so much into the social media stuff. It's important, but we don't know, to your point, how important it is. And how do we move what we call slacktivist to activist, which is something we're focusing on as we prepare for Amplify Austin. These giving days around the country are largely driven through digital means, and so our goal is to move all these people that like us on Facebook to become donors to, mm-hmm. you know, whatever agency they care a lot about. And we find to get people to come to us on Facebook, you know, we have to put pictures up there.
Right, right. I learned the other day that Facebook weights the content you put on Facebook. So if you put a picture up, it will get circulated to more and more of your little network. If you put a link up, it'll get circulated to some of your network. If you put just text up, hardly any of your network, which is really interesting. So this is kind of the 10-minute warning now for the end of the whole talk. I'm going to ask one more question to our guests and then leave a few minutes at the end for you guys to ask questions. We've got a microphone there in the middle of the audience, if you can see it there, or you can stand up and probably just ask your question that way. So one more question for all of you, and then we'll turn it over to the audience. I want to ask one more hard issue, and that is, how do you find funding? Where do you go? Do you go to your city? Do you go to your state? Do you go to your friends? Do you go to your family? Do you put aside savings to launch this effort? How do you find the money to get your social good off the ground?
I'm going to go real quick because all I'm going to do is listen because we haven't found it yet.
Well, you know, I'm really grateful for the work Patsy's doing because as a chemist, you realize the most important ingredient, money, you know, for the lifeblood and cash flow of stuff. But funding. So what I realized was I didn't want to compete with any of the nonprofits, right? I want to, you know, I come in peace. I wanted to invite hundreds of them to meet thousands of people. So I realized I didn't want to go after their funders. So what I did was I said, well, how can we monetize that? So we invite sponsors to sponsor our mobilization campaigns. And these are people that want to get in front of our audience. So, but we also put some parameters. So Wells Fargo, who is a wonderful sponsor, talks about financial literacy. They don't talk about how I'm going to sign you up for a bank account or something like that. So we make sure that they're in alignment with our work. And so that's how we've been able to go after foundations or grants around that and around our audience, but making sure that it's mission aligned. And, you know, it's telling a story again because we haven't found the grants for, mobilize a community around this issue. You know, it's not. They want that service provider who is actually doing the reading or the math or the STEM activity. We are helping enable that, so it's a little bit of a harder sell. So we've had to become a little bit creative around that.
Yeah, I think probably all of our work up here is sort of one step removed from providing the direct services that most corporate and public foundations like to fund. They have their criteria for what they're accomplishing in a community or around the world. And so it's difficult, I think, to find people that look on that macro level. But what I would say is build a team. You got to build a team. You can't do it alone. And so tell your story and find somebody who believes in it almost as much as you do. And, you know, it's all about spheres of influence. It's like, I'll go to, you know, I'm telling you, my friend, I've been doing this 6 years, and it's like, my friends, I'm at the point where I'm like, all right, one more time, we're going to do this again. Pitch in. But I've got to broaden, you know, I've got to build a bigger board so that my board can go to their friends or their, you know, people who also will believe in the mission. And you just build that circle. And again, to your point, it doesn't happen overnight, and it takes persistence. You just have to keep working at it.
You know, I wanted to add, you know, you can also turn a problem into an opportunity. So, you know, we've got this population, we're leading the nation in child, right? So what do we have at our events where you have 10, 15, 20,000 people? You have a lot of soiled diapers, right? So it became a big issue. How do you keep the bathrooms clean? Well, then we created, being an engineer, a diaper model, and we could show that an event for 10,000 people will have 2,000 diapers that will be disposed, right? So then you go to the makers of diaper companies and say, you know what? Wouldn't you love to donate at, you know, at these events or be a funder for this event, because this is your target market. So what turned out to be one of our problems was actually a good funding opportunity for us.
I love that too, not the 10,000 soiled diapers part, but the fact that none of you are demonizing the corporate world, but you're really working with them to see how you can further your efforts for the nonprofit or philanthropic world. So thank you so much. We've got about 4 minutes left for questions from the audience. So if any of you would like to ask a question to our speakers, now is the time to do it. You can stand up. You can approach the microphone, whatever you want to do. Go ahead. The question was, how do you approach applying for grants?
Well, you start with by doing your research. There's a foundation center. You can go to GuideStar and look online at foundations. And you have to realize that your work has to meet the foundation's need. So if you find a foundation that looks like they're interested in the same thing you are, I would pick up the phone and start trying to talk to someone before you go through the laborious process of filling out even a letter of inquiry. Again, foundations are not unlike any of the rest of us. It's about building relationships. And if the work you're doing meets their need, you are going to have a wonderful partnership.
People Fund Austin is another resource, too, that you can check out if you're looking into grant opportunities. People Fund, all one word. So, okay, question at the microphone.
Okay, I'm a stay-at-home mom for 8 years, and I literally have no job to go back to because I was a newspaper copy editor.
Yeah.
Gone.
Bye.
So I know I want to work in the nonprofit sector. I know I'm interested in education and housing. I don't know how to convince anyone to give me a job because, you know, do I put my 2 years of PTA treasurer on a resume, or do you have any tips for, you know, trying to transition back into the workforce? I don't have a big resume. I have, you know, some volunteer stuff here.
I'll throw a couple ideas out there. First of all, start volunteering at that nonprofit you want to work for so they get to know you. And then also get yourself the money for them to hire you. So you're a great copywriter. So everybody needs help writing grants. So start helping them, you know, be part of the solution and say, I'm going to start writing grants for you. And I write really well. They're going to want you to be part of their team. But getting to know them and them getting to know you is really an important first step. And you've had PTA experience, you know, that is great experience in the nonprofit world. So those are all ways to start.
And it's huge. I didn't get hired by United Way because I was a chemist. I got hired because I had been, you know, very successful in volunteer work while I was staying at home. And, you know, what I did was I went back to those agencies that I volunteered for and said, okay, two of my kids have gone off to school. It's time for me to go back to work. What do you think? Can I get a job? I had that same question. Can I get a job? I know I don't want to be a chemist anymore. I'm ready to go back to work. And I promise you, within a month, I was working. So I think you need to give a lot of value to the experience you've had, you know, as a volunteer.
So that's your resume, your volunteer
job. It was. You know, I raised X amount for this organization and Y amount for that organization, and I served as an officer in this organization, and oh, by the way, you know, I worked as a chemist a long time ago.
Okay. Yeah. We've got time for one more question, then I'll let Gigi close.
My question is about nonprofits cooperating together. You touched on it a little bit, Ms. Azevedo, when you said you didn't want to go after other people's money. I started working with homeless in a church organization about 6 years ago, and they had so many questions that I didn't have the answers to that I started looking for who are all the people that serve these folks. And there's so many, and yet it seems to be very difficult to get those people to work together, to bring their resources together to work on a bigger problem. Do you have any suggestions for how to make something like that happen?
I call that the 1,000 points of scattered light. And, you know, and so bringing them around a common experience. So getting them, you know, organizational behavior, here's where my corporate world comes in. You know, when you get together, you first form, but then you storm, then you norm, and then finally you perform. And I think sometimes in the nonprofit world, we think because we have sort of the same vision, we should immediately go into performing. And we first have to norm, and then you have to storm and figure out who's working together. And then I would put it around a common theme. So don't expect yourselves to suddenly start working well together seamlessly at the very beginning. Do something easy. Do a summit, do a conference, do a day thing where they all come together. And then you start networking and talking. And then especially if you invite your funders are going to say, hey, you two are very aligned. You should either come together or why am I funding both of you? You need to share resources. So start with something a little bit more less threatening, and then you allow the relationships to start building, and then you get into that storming and then forming and norming and performing.
Thank you all today. We really appreciate your coming out, Sylvia, Patsy, and Charlie. Greatly appreciate it. You've gotten a lot of information today, and since my background is in computer science, I'm going to actually put it in bite-sized, bit-sized pieces, some of the information that you heard today. And that's my skill set that I bring to the nonprofit community. First of all, you heard about being motivated to action. So that's your first thing, is to be motivated. Secondly, you look at your skill set that you have to make an impact within that motivation. Then you look at your passion. Do I have a passion for this to take it through the long haul, or at least take it to completion with my segment that I've agreed to do? Sometimes you just agree to one thing, and that's all you can do based on everything else you have to do within your household, but take it to completion as your passion allows. Then you take action. You do what you do. You do what you can do. But where do you start? You start in your homes, teaching your children about volunteerism, teaching them how to outreach, being in the PTA, doing the budget. I mean, you have so many other skill sets that you don't even think about that you apply within the things that you do every day. So, and after that, then what do? You get your hands dirty. You say, okay, I'm here. I'm willing to form within this organization. Give me a small part so that I can see if I like it. And if you don't, give yourself permission to move to the next thing. This is not a lifelong commitment. As you can see, we've each moved to different things within our career based on where we are within our growth. So give yourself permission to decide that you don't like it or it doesn't fit your schedule right now and move on to something else, because there are tons of opportunities that can use every skill set that you have. And we all know as women, we do many things. So I'll ask you to do one thing for me when you leave here. Just make a list of all the things that you do. When you talk about building your resume, all the things that you like to do, and then sell it to your two-year-old. If he buys it or if she buys it, you're on a roll. Sell it to your college student, you're really on a roll because you'll have to do it through texting. So thank you again. We greatly, greatly appreciate you, and thank you a bunch.